This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
Hello and welcome to the This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Ed Bauscher, sitting in for Georgie Frost this week, and here at Share Radio we're with you on digital radio across the country and also online and through the Share Radio mobile app. And I'm joined this week in the studio by This Is Money editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And we're going to talk through some of the stories that they've been investigating over the last 7 days on the This Is Money website. And on the agenda today, a pensions victory for Money, Mail and This Is Money. George Osborne won't be making any major pension changes in next week's budget. But what will the Chancellor announce next week? And new rules will soon let most people earn £1,000 of savings interest tax-free. Yet can anybody actually explain how this will work? All sounds a bit mad. So, good morning to both of you, Simon and Rachel. Thanks so much for coming on today. Really good to see you both.
Hello, Ed.
So let's start with pensions and a victory for Money, Mail and This Is Money, which is obviously good news. After much fear, speculation, newspaper column inches and airtime on this very show, we were all wondering about what the Chancellor might do with our pensions in this budget. But it appears now that he'll do, well, nothing. Just think back to the halcyon days of last year and a rise in state pensions.
As a result of our commitment to those who've worked hard all their lives and contributed to our society, I can confirm that next year the basic state pension will rise by £3.35 to £119.30 a week. That's the biggest real terms increase to the basic state pension in 15 years.
Yeah. Cheers soon turned to anguish when fears gathered apace that the Chancellor, looking at the juicy £21 billion the Treasury sacrifices every year in pension relief, would find a way to keep a big slice of that for his deficit reduction plans. Would he announce a flat rate of tax relief for all pension savers, or would he go for the nuclear option and launch a pensions ISA? Well, for now at least, it appears neither. But don't get too settled yet, because there are fears we've not seen the end of this. So, Simon, I guess this is a good result for you, but apparently a Treasury source is just saying now isn't the right time. So do you think this is something that will come back later in another budget?
Yeah, I think this is a good result for us. I think that we, This Is Money, and our colleagues on Money Mail have campaigned against these changes to pensions, because I think that, from my personal view...
Actually, just quickly, yeah. I should have said earlier, could you just sum up what was proposed again, so anyone's not up to
speed? In his summer budget, George Osborne announced this big consultation into pension tax relief. Now, the suggestion in the consultation paper was that the current system that we have, whereby most people can save into a pension tax-free, so basically you put your money into a pension and then it gets bumped up back to the level that you would have been at before you'd paid tax, unless you're a very, very high earner or you've put a lot of money into your pension. Now, the argument in that consultation paper was that this was confusing and that people didn't really understand it, and it wasn't an incentive to save. So there were two suggestions, or mainly, in there. The first one was that we could switch to a ISA-style system, where you paid tax on the way in, but then when you took the money out at the end, you drew your income from your pension, that was tax-free, as it is if you take income from an ISA. And the other suggestion was that we should change the tax relief system, and instead of it being at your tax rate that you pay, so 20%, 40%, 45%, we would have a flat rate instead. And then there's been a huge amount of debate as to what that flat rate should be. Now, our argument was that, A, the pension ISA system was crazy, because what would differentiate that from an ISA? You might as well just save into an ISA in that instance.
Yep.
And the reason why people would just save into an ISA in that instance is because with an ISA, you can take the money out whenever you want. Whereas with a pension, it's locked up till it's 55.
Sure.
Which is one of the great drawbacks of a pension, but also one of its great virtues. And the argument against the flat rate was that basically it removes that principle of tax-free pension saving. It places an arbitrary number on it, and I could see a point where, say, we set it at 30% now or 25% now, within 10 years, cash-hungry governments had whittled that down to almost nothing.
But it looks like we've definitely got a pause next week, but it may come again. I mean, do you think it's going to come again? Will Osborne try and do this again next year or in 6 months' time, for that matter?
Yes, and I mean, we haven't had any official confirmation that he's not going to do anything on Wednesday.
Sure, so sure.
As a man who likes to pull a rabbit out of the hat, you never know, he could do. But the suggestion has been that with all the issues surrounding Brexit and so on, this would be a bad time to be doing anything that could lead to any headlines about George Osborne raiding people's pension pots. And that is how it will be seen. It would be sold as a boost to lower paid people, but in reality it would be a tax grab. So it's on ice for now. But I definitely think that he will come back to this. I think that unfortunately Mr. Osborne looks at this money as a pot that he wants to tap into, and he has made a pledge to balance the books by 2020, and you know, he needs to do everything he possibly can to do that.
But, you know, I can understand particularly your arguments against the pension ISA, but was the flat rate tax relief, Rachel, was that such a dumb idea, really? I mean, that would give some people more pension tax relief, wouldn't it?
In principle, it would, depending on what level that was set at. And that is how he was going to sell it. And indeed, he had sold it quite successfully, that idea to the Sun, that people on lower incomes would see a boost. But as Simon says, the fear is with that longer term penalties that we might see, that number can be shifted around, and then it's not necessarily a boost in the longer term for lower income earners at all. And also, when we talk about higher, lower income, it's sort of, you know, you don't have to be super rich to be earning 40% to get up to that rate at some point in your career. And it's definitely not going away, this one. It's too expensive, I think, for it to be off the table for something to tap. And the reasons, interestingly, that were given by Treasury sources for ditching this were short-term ones. As you say, it was you know, we don't want to upset anything at the moment with the uncertainty of the global outlook and Brexit, all sort of hopefully temporary measures, and also that we need a bit more time for other pensions changes to sort of bed in. We've just seen auto enrolment, which a lot of smaller employers are still trying to grapple with, and we've also seen pension freedoms, which it will take a long time for people to adjust to as well. So he says, you know, the implication was it's simply not the right time to do it, but the implication was not that it wasn't the right thing to do at all.
But former Pensions Minister Steve Webb, I mean, he was the Pensions Minister in the Coalition, wasn't he? He's widely seen as a pensions expert. He says, Simon, there is a case for reform. So are you saying you don't want any more pension reforms for the next 10 years, or are there one or two things you'd want to look at, or do you just think we've done enough already, leave it alone?
I'd love to see George Osborne stand up and say, I'm going to leave pensions alone for 10 years. I think it would give people a really great opportunity to plan. I know that Steve argued for a flat rate. Steve argued, I think, for 33%, Steve Webb did, and that gives this idea of, I think, put £2 in, get one free. I think that's how that was going to be sold. I mean, my argument would be that this principle of tax-free pension saving at your rate of tax goes all the way back to 1921, and I think that it is something that is worth defending, because I see a slippery slope, as I said, where it gets whittled away. And I also think that we worry about those around retirement age now, or those near retiring or those retiring, not having enough money. Yet those people had better pensions, more secure jobs, cheaper house prices than the younger generation that's having the pension saving benefits hacked away at. And if we cut that tax relief, it will be essentially a tax grab on aspiration. It will be taking it away from all the people earlier in their careers, in their 20s and their 30s and their 40s, who were hoping to earn more money over the years, because that tax relief plus some compounding over the years is a real benefit. And yes, there is an argument that most of the tax relief goes to higher earners. But that only makes that's logical, because if you pay more tax in the first place,
sure,
then you will get more tax relief.
Yep.
And I think the only other thing I would say on it is that we often talk about this as a cost, as if we're spending this money. But we don't spend this money. We choose to forego taking it in as tax. We say, OK, we won't tax you on your pension on the way in. That's an incentive to save, an incentive to lock your money away to age 55, and then we'll tax it on the way out. And there is a big difference between spending money and foregoing tax.
OK. Now, given that we probably are going to see more pension changes next year, whenever, I mean, is that an argument for saying, well, actually, why bother putting your money in pensions in the first place? You said, Simon, you know, we can put just over £15,000 in an ISA. At least the rules haven't changed there for a long time. You can take the money whenever you like. Just forget pensions. Do you think that's a sensible strategy, Rachel?
On the contrary, Ed, I think that while things are still up for grabs, we have to take advantage of pensions relief. Tax relief will never be better than it is now. And what we've seen actually is people shoveling a huge amount of money over the past few months into their pensions, which is going to cost, well, not cost, but is it a cost, a large cost that the Treasury will have to forego, as Simon says. So no, keep on ploughing money in. And I agree that now is not the time necessarily for further meddling with pensions tax relief and deciding who gets what. But there definitely is scope for a reform in the way that we talk about pensions and think about pensions. None of us are saving enough, and it's going to be a real problem. People underestimate how long they're going to live for, maybe because they don't like to think about it, or we all think that we're immortal. And so we need... I mean, Ros Altman actually talked about this week. And
she's now the pensions minister, isn't she?
Indeed, yeah. And she had some interesting things to say about apps and gamification of pension saving, which I'm not sure... No, actually, I think it is a good idea. I think that you need people to be more engaged earlier on in life in how much they're saving and getting an idea of what that would mean for the quality of life later on, because we don't have enough, really. I mean, we should be saving about 15% of our income, roughly, our whole lives in order to be able to retire on what we want to. And who's doing that?
So scary. So scary. Now, also, before the leaks came through that George Osborne isn't going to do this, and as you said earlier, Simon, it's all just leaks. There's been no official... There were no official announcements he was going to make the changes, were there? And then there have been no official announcements saying he isn't going to make the changes. But when we thought he was going to make the changes, there was talk of a sort of a Northern Rock-style run on pension schemes, Simon. Was that a real worry? Was that actually going to happen, or was that just a bit of sort of overexcitement?
No, I don't think so. I think, if anything, there was more chance, as Rachel mentioned just then, for people to shove more money into their pensions. And I think there is actually an issue here, which is there's been some big changes to pensions already in terms of the amount of money you can put in. There's a thing called the lifetime allowance, and that was £1.8 million in 2010, and it's fallen to £1 million now. And there is talk that whilst he said he's not going to do anything with his tax relief, he could cut that further to, say, £750,000. And a £750,000 lifetime allowance, which is your whole pot, not the amount of money you've put into your pension, basically would buy you a pension of about £30,000 a year. That's plenty of money, and that's great, and a lot of people will be very happy with that, but it is not the preserve of the super rich. And then you have the annual allowance, where you can put £40,000 a year in, which also, again, sounds like a lot of money, and you think, who on earth manages to put £40,000 into their pension? But actually, because of the way it's calculated, this hits some relatively normal people in professions where they get final salary pensions as well. And so there has already been a massive crackdown on how much money the wealthier members of society can put into a pension. So I think it is a mistake when people say that basically what we're doing is refusing to help the lower paid and the wealthy can just stick as much money in as they like.
And the lifetime allowance is one of my hobby horses, actually, because I think what people don't realise, if let's say I put £200,000 into my pension pot and then my investments do really, really well over a period of years, that actually gets to £1 million. And it's the final size of the pot, isn't it? I mean, that's what's so scary about it.
You're right, absolutely, because you don't have to be earning that much money. If you're on a good professional salary, 40-something grand, your career earnings going up over the years and the compound growth of, say, if you get 6%, you're hitting that million, aren't you?
Yeah, very scary. Well, moving on to staking with pensions, but there's also been this idea that the budget should introduce a new way to let people see the money they've saved for their retirement in one place. And this is what the consumer group Which want. So here's the head of campaigns, Pete Morey, telling us a bit more about his idea.
Well, really, it comes down to the fact that nearly half of people who we've surveyed, over 50 employed with a pension, said to us that they're not confident about the money they had saved up for their retirement. And 4 in 10 of them said that they find it difficult to keep track of their pension pots. And 1/3 of them say it's too time consuming. So looking at all that evidence, that's why we're calling today on the government to use next week's budget and work with the industry and with consumer groups to introduce a pensions dashboard. dashboard, and this would give people easy access to all the key information they need about their pensions and their savings in one place.
I mean, someone like me who's worked in a number of places over my life, I've got about three different pension pots, and it is hard to keep track. So would this amalgamate all of those into one?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's very common. The Department for Work and Pensions did their own study back in 2011, and at that time they estimated that on average an individual will work for 11 employers during their working life and therefore will be likely to have perhaps as many pension pots. And, you know, we are finding when we're talking to people that they are struggling to keep track of all of those different pension pots, that they want all of that information in one place, and we think this is really important.
So, Rachel, what do you think about this initiative?
I think it's extraordinary that it's seen as even remotely revolutionary, the idea that we should be able to know how much we have to retire on at any time that we choose to. Particularly, I mean, technology makes everything else so much simpler in terms of our investing, seeing how much money we have, online banking in our current accounts, that we can't do that with our pensions. And it just makes it so much harder to plan, therefore. I mean, it has to be done as soon as possible, and I know that it is something that's being looked into. The problem, as Ros Altman said again a couple of days ago, is that pension providers just aren't up to it yet. Even if you phone them up and ask them what's in your pot, you're going to have a problem getting a straight answer out of them and, you know, a simple, plain pounds and pence number. So then to get them all to do that and then to get them all to put it into one place, it's going to take a long time. But I see it as very urgent.
Do you agree with that, Simon? Yeah.
Yeah, I do. But I question who's going to create this pensions dashboard. Are we going to get the government to create this pensions dashboard, spend a load of money on paying some outsourced IT contractors to build something that they then have to abandon because it doesn't work properly? I think this is one for the pensions industry and the pension companies. And I think it's probably is something that will come along soon enough where someone says, well, I tell you what, you open an account with us and we will allow you to pull all of your other pensions in so that you can see them in one place. And I think that would be a great ability for people, and especially because I think that might happen because then it will encourage people to maybe move their pension from, if it's a defined contribution pension, to that other provider and consolidate them into one place so they're investing all in one place. And I would say to anyone who does have old work pensions that are defined contribution pensions, you should probably look into putting them all into one place because there can be serious benefits from doing so.
Okay, that's good advice. Let's take a very quick break.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Good morning, I'm Ed Bauscher and you're listening to Share Radio, and the team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are back in the studio for our weekly catch-up with us running through some of the stories they've been looking into over the last 7 days. And today I'm joined by This Is Money editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And of course, every week we do this show in partnership with NS&I. So, there are divisions in the Tory party and the Brexit referendum is coming. Does that mean we're going to have a boring budget? But if it isn't going to be too boring, what else could we expect to hear? Here is David Brooks, partner at public accounting firm BDO.
The first point to make is that we expect this to be a revenue-raising budget, so not a giveaway to the electorate, but also not a tax-neutral position. So where will this additional tax come from? Well, there's been a lot of speculation around pensions and raising more money from pension changes. But recently the government's announced that it's not the right time to do that. And so we don't expect any major changes to pensions this time. So where will the money come from? Well, one obvious area the Chancellor could look at is fuel duty, because with oil prices low at the moment, it could be a good opportunity to increase fuel duty without too much pushback from the electorate.
And this is Simon Newark, VAT partner at UHY Hacker Young.
We're likely to see a series of difficult decisions, as politicians frequently say, possibly accompanied by a number of giveaways spun for all their worth. Some may even be linked to Britain remaining in the European Union, for the Chancellor is renowned as being a consummate political animal. There'll be moves to tighten government spending, although nothing like the levels that are really needed to solve the economic problems we have, and more tinkering with taxation to put more money in people's pockets.
And finally, the calming presence of Andrew Sentence, senior economic advisor at PwC, former member of the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee and Share Radio regular, with his overview of the economy Osborne will be working with.
Despite all the concerns about the global economy, the UK has been growing reasonably well over the last few years. So as long as the economy continues to grow, that's going to bring in more tax revenue, and that's going to make a reasonable backdrop for the Chancellor's budget. But he's starting from a position where the deficit is still very large and he wants to move it into a surplus. So he doesn't have a lot of room for manoeuvre for big giveaways. He's probably going to try and make changes which will offset each other. So where he gives with one hand, he'll be taking back with another.
So, Simon, we had a spread of opinions there. What are your thoughts about what may come in the budget next week?
I think that George Osborne will definitely look to raise some money. I think it's probably safe to say that. It will be interesting to see where he manages to do this because, I mean, famously in the autumn statement, he found some money down the back of the sofa, didn't
yes,
he?
Yeah, and actually
managed to turn it into a little bit of a giveaway, although he hit buy-to-let landlords with higher stamp duty.
Sure.
I mean, could he hit buy-to-let landlords again? Maybe they're being squeezed as much as they can at the moment. Could he try and go for something from property? He could do, maybe, but it would be unlikely to see him raise stamp duty again. So, you know, those are the very popular options. Fuel duty is one. Now, he finds himself in a very interestingly difficult position with fuel duty because basically the oil price has risen slightly over the past few weeks. And if you notice at the pumps, the price of petrol and diesel has risen back towards a pound, depending where you buy.
Yeah.
Now, if you buy from the big supermarkets, I'm pretty sure it's still just under a pound.
Right.
Now, if that holds for the next 5 days, does George Osborne want to stand up and announce a fuel duty rise that pushes the price of petrol, the average price of petrol, back above a pound? That's not going to win him the greatest of headlines the next morning, is it? So I wonder what he'll do there.
Rachel, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, fuel duty, because as the wholesale cost of fuel has gone down, the percentage of the cost of the pumps that goes towards tax has increased. And so now I've forgotten when it's 80-something pence or something goes in tax, including VAT, on the price that we pay at the pumps. So will he want to increase that proportion? He's going to end up with a lot of very angry drivers. But at the same time, they have seen their costs fall overall. So perhaps that's an easy target. Now, Simon says he's going to be drumming up the cash again and he has to find it somewhere. He's bound on all the big ones. He can't move VAT, national insurance, income tax, because he's promised he won't touch any of those. He can't go after pensions because, as we've discussed, that's not up for grabs either.
Sure.
Triple lock pension, that's the big cost, and he can't touch that either. So what's he going to go for? I mean, I'm really excited to see what in sort of innovations in tax grab he'll
excited.
Come up with.
Excited!
Curious. I mean, yes. Yeah. But the last one he came up with, the insurance premium tax, which no one really thought about or heard about until suddenly he decided he was going to increase it.
That was quite clever.
There's always going to be another sneaky one to go for. Yeah. But maybe it's a time not to go mad in a budget again. I mean, we've got three a year now, and I absolutely don't think this is the way to come up with economic policy, because by virtue of doing it that way, a lot of it is behind closed doors and it's not up for discussion until it's been announced, and then everyone sort of works out the detail later and has a little panic about it, or works out what sneaky things he's come up with.
Exactly.
This is not the way to do things through budgets.
No, and he doesn't tell the whole story, anything like the whole story, through his speech, does he? You find out more the next day. Simon, did you want to say something else on that?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say that actually there is one thing that has been talked about at the margins that could potentially happen, and I could see him doing something on this, which is salary sacrifice. So under salary sacrifice, basically, it's mainly used for people for their pensions, but we also use it for things like childcare vouchers as well. You choose to give up part of your earnings, and instead of paying it to you, your company pays it into your pension scheme. And that saves you money, because not only do you get the income tax relief on it, you don't pay national insurance. And it also saves the company money, because they're not paying the extra national insurance on your salary. Now, this has become quite commonplace as a way for people's pensions to be, you know, to be paid and to be collected. And it is costing the Treasury quite a lot of money in tax that it would otherwise be taking in. And I've also seen various sort of things around salary sacrifice where there's even suggestions that you could buy things like a laptop or a mobile phone or a car or things like that. And I wonder whether there will be some form of, because there actually aren't any, there don't appear to be any hard and fast rules that says you can only use this for sensible stuff like a pension. You can't Sure. use it for more frivolous stuff. Yeah. So I wonder whether something will be done on that.
I asked the HMRC about this a couple of months ago, what you were and weren't allowed to salary sacrifice. There are no rules. I mean, if you want a new iPhone, if you want anything, really, I mean, the legitimate things seem to be sort of bicycles and pensions, but it's absolutely whatever you like. And it was mentioned in the last budget report that that was something that was going to be looked into. Also, we looked at this report from the Office of Tax Simplification this week into national insurance and income tax and the possibility of an alignment of the two. And there was a line in it that said that for the first time last year, since 1997, there was a transfer of cash from the sort of general income tax pot into the national insurance pot because we didn't have enough in the national insurance pot to pay out. I mean, this is arguably a significant contribution to that will have been through salary sacrifice, that people are sneaking out of their national insurance payments, and so we have to.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think if he does, if George Osborne does do it, and I agree he might, he's hoping that we won't understand it, and so it'll be an easy tax rise. And then I guess it's up to you guys in This Is Money and us here at Share Radio to sort of explain what's going on, because some people could lose a lot of money.
Yeah, and do you know the people who would lose out the most would be basic rate taxpayers? Because basically, if you're a basic, the two taxes aren't completely aligned, but if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you pay 12%. Is it 12 or 13? 12% national insurance, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're effectively, your tax rate isn't really 20%, it's 32%. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, it's an extra 2%, is it? Yeah. So you pay 42. So actually, basically, by doing salary sacrifice, if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you get a much better deal because you're actually gaining that extra 12%, sure. You know, and so it would hit those harder.
Thinking about it, you said, is it 12 or 13? It might be 12 and a half, you know, but I can't quite remember. But anyway, we'll be going to turn on to savings in just a second, but we're going to have another really quick.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Simon's just looked it up. What's the national insurance rate?
It is 12%.
And oh, well done, Simon. Well done.
For the higher rate taxpayers, it's an extra 2%.
Very good. Well, it's a really, really, really important point. But anyway, let's move on to savings now, and let's just remind ourselves what we're doing here. I'm Ed Bauscher, and you're listening to Share Radio. And the team from This Is Money, the award-winning personal finance website, are back in the studio for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the stories they've been looking at over the last 7 days. And I'm joined today by This Is Money editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And we're doing this show, of course, as we do every week, in partnership with NS&I. Now, earlier in the show, we were talking about our debt problem, but apparently we are also bad at savings too. Nearly one in five people in the UK admits that they don't save any money most months. And a study by Santander also found that more than a quarter of the people who did save wish they could save more. Carolyn Shakarovich from the Money Advice Service tells us they challenged a group of 22 people who claimed they were struggling to save with advice like this.
We asked them to have a look at their sort of food shopping, so people who were setting out menus for the week and then went to shop for those menus. Also in terms of switching, so people with their utility bills, their mobile phones.
And Helen Beerton, she's the Santander head of savings, spoke about the tough savings environment.
It's a disappointing environment, isn't it, for savers at the moment? But, you know, saving is still a good habit to get into. We've got the government introducing the new personal savings allowance from the 6th of April, which means that all interest paid on any bank accounts, current accounts, savings accounts, will be paid gross. That means that all of the interest you earn will be paid to you, whereas in the past banks would deduct 20% and pay that to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. So we've got this change coming in that means that more of the money that you save earns interest and comes back to you. And I think, you know, yes, we identified about 10% of the population fall into a category of all gone againers. They're the people who probably struggle more than most, where they finally get to the end of the month and haven't got much money set aside. They might need to think about it a little bit more, but just a little bit of budgeting and a little bit of control could make a difference. And as I said earlier, a small amount of saving can soon make a big difference.
But what can we be doing differently to help ourselves save? We spoke last week about the death of the cash ISA, and the Chancellor is again getting some blame for that, because last year he told savings he was abolishing tax on the first £1,000 of interest they earned from any high street account, although it's only £500 tax-free for higher rate taxpayers. And these new rules, the biggest change to the way savings are taxed since the early 90s, come in next month. But it appears nobody can explain how they will work. So, Rachel, I gather you're getting your post bags are stuffed with letters on these changes. There's a lot of confusion. So what is confusing people in particular, would you say?
So you're pretty much OK if you're below that limit, it seems, that banks just won't take that interest from you. That's previously how it worked, that they would collect it. You'd never see it. They'd never take the tax on the interest. But if you do have to pay tax, somehow that's got to be taken from you. And how that's calculated and whether it comes through your tax code, but then how it's calculated on your tax code is all pretty complicated stuff. And no one seems to know precisely how that's going to play out.
So just to be clear, if I'm a basic rate taxpayer now and I've got money in a savings account, the tax is taken automatically and I don't need to do anything. Is that right?
That's right.
Under the new rules, tax won't be deducted, and if I'm a basic rate taxpayer, again, I don't need to worry. Is that the situation?
Unless you've got a lot of savings and then you're earning a lot of interest, in which case it's hoped that you will be charged that tax through your tax code, and that will be calculated roughly on what you paid last time round. But what if you spent all your money in the meantime, or your interest rate changes significantly over the year? How are they going to calculate that? And that seems to be the issue here.
So if I'm earning £25,000 a year, I'm a basic rate taxpayer, but I've got a massive savings pot at the Building Society, so I've got more than £1,000 worth of interest. Does that mean I have to fill in a tax return? And you're saying that actually, no, I won't, because in theory, at least, this tax code will sort the problem out for me.
In theory, if you weren't doing self-assessment already, you shouldn't have to start doing it. It should come out of your tax code. And as you say, that sort of... It is precisely that sort of demographic that will be hit, people on lower incomes but with more savings. Who are they? Pensioners. To not have clear messaging around these changes, when it's going to affect pensioners in particular. Pensioners, one, and then a smaller group, but also significant, people who have, for in the short term, a large pot of money and then spend it, say, if you have money in an account that you plan to buy a house with, so you have it over the short term, your tax bill on that interest that you accrue is going to vary wildly from one year to the next.
So you could end up being overtaxed, actually.
Yeah, and in which case, the new HMRC says you contact HMRC, you can explain it, you can change things, you can apply for refunds. But I think also part of the problem is that anything that involves sort of more bureaucracy and more interaction with HMRC sets us up for a little bit of confusion or disaster. I mean, it's hard enough at the best times to get through to them, and any sort of clarification is often very difficult. I mean, we just have messages all the time from readers with problems with HMRC, so if that's what it comes down to, you have to contact HMRC to sort it out, then maybe we're in trouble.
Yeah, we've had horrendous problems, haven't we, with HMRC phone lines. But Simon, what about higher rate taxpayers? So how much interest-free money do they get? So tax-free money, rather.
£500. So it's going to create a slightly awkward situation for them as well. And one of the things that has happened with this, so our colleagues over on Money Mail ran this story earlier this week on this confusion, because they had then gone to HMRC and asked them some of these questions, and they weren't really quite happy with the answers, which were a bit confusing. And also, we do have people writing in saying that they've gone to their bank and said to them, so I'm not going to get any tax on my savings interest now, am I? And the position should be that they're not going to get any tax on their savings interest, but their bank has said, no, we'll continue to tax you at 20%, and then you'll have to claim that back. And it is,
the banks don't really know what's going on.
So some of the banks don't appear to know what's going on either. And I mean, that could just be the person you're speaking to. It might not be the bank itself. But I think that it's probably not been... It was communicated very well in terms of a look at what I'm giving you, isn't this wonderful? But it's not been communicated very well in the actual practicalities of how it will work. And as Rachel said, it's wonderfully reassuring to know that we could just call up HMRC and they'll sort it all out for us. Last time I called them, I spent 42 minutes waiting on the phone.
So what can people do if they're still confused, they don't know what to do?
They probably need to get their bank to tell them exactly what they're doing. And once their bank tells them exactly what they're doing, they can work out whether they're A, paying the tax, or B, not paying the tax. So then they can find out whether they need to claim it back. And I would say that what they probably need to do is keep a close eye on all the interests that they get this year, keep those statements, pull them together so that you know at the end of that first year of this allowance coming in exactly how much interest you've got and whether you've gone under or over.
OK, well, sticking with savings, we know that savings rates are rubbish at the moment. So some people think, well, let's go to investing in the stock market, where you can potentially get a higher return, but of course, at a higher risk. Now, Simon, you've been looking at the Dividend Heroes and also at DIY Investing ISAs and your picks of the platform. So these are all really important issues for people who are perhaps starting out in investing in the stock market or indeed have been doing it for a long time. So, Simon, let's start with DIY. Investing, you know, what's that all about? What does it mean, and why is it getting more popular?
Well, it sharpens in our minds at this time of year because the tax year is running out, and so we've only got a certain amount of time to use up this year's ISA allowance. And you can put that money into a cash ISA, or you can put it into an investing ISA. And what's changed, you know, really dramatically over the last 10 to 15 years is quite how easy it's got to invest. And you can go online to any number of companies that run these DIY investing platforms. You can see all your investments in one place. Share dealing is cheaper. Fund dealing is cheaper. You can buy investment trusts and ETFs. And basically, it's a way of taking control of your money, investing in the stock market or in bonds and trying to grow your wealth over time.
And so does it matter what platform you choose? There's loads of platforms, aren't there? People like Hargreaves Lansdown and Alliance Trust Savings. Does it really matter? Are they all much of a muchness?
No, they're not really. And that's, I think, this is unfortunately one of the first hurdles that people have to get over, isn't it? Is choosing the platform. Because they charge in a couple of different ways. So the big difference in how these platforms charge is that they used to charge mainly by taking a cut from your investments. So they would get paid a commission fee by the fund management companies. That stopped. So then they changed to charging you an explicit fee. And one way they do that is either as a percentage of the investments that you've got in your pot, or alternatively, a different platform might charge you a flat fee. Now, depending on what kind of investor you are and how much money you've got invested, either of those two things will help you better. So if you've got a small amount of money, then the percentage is actually quite a good way to go because it can work out to be actually not a lot of money at all. So, for example, if you go to Hargreaves Lansdown, which is not one of the cheapest but charges a percentage fee, they charge 0.45%. If you've got £10,000 in your investing ISA, that's £45 a year. Now, if you go to one of the companies that charges a flat fee, but you've got a smaller pot, that flat fee will represent a larger chunk of your small pot. But if you've got a couple of £100,000, then if you go to someone like Interactive Investor, for example, that will charge you £80 a year, well, that works out as a very small percentage of that pot. Muddying the waters slightly is then the trading costs of buying and selling those investments. And what we tend to find with platforms is if they charge a flat fee, you have to pay to buy and sell funds, perhaps £10 a time. If they charge a percentage fee, you don't have to pay to buy and sell funds. And that's a spectrum. They sort of move across there. And so what you need to do when you're choosing one is sit down and think, what kind of thing am I going to be doing? How often am I going to be buying and selling investments? And am I going to buy and sell shares and investment trusts and ETFs as well, which carry share dealing costs? How big is my pot going to be? And look at the costs, but then also look at what they're offering you in terms of help, model portfolios, guides, calculators, tools, and in terms of user experience, because cheapest isn't always best.
So it's all quite complicated. I mean, I guess that means that you can't recommend one simple platform for everyone, but it depends on your circumstances.
No, we can't. But what we do have on the site is a roundup. And if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/DIY, you will find our pick of the best and cheapest DIY investing platforms. And what we've done is we've run through a list of those that we think stand out for some reason. We've described what they charge, what they do, what kind of investor they're good for and what kind of investor they might not be so good for. And my view, I've been running that roundup now for a good three, four years, is that if you pick one of the platforms on that list, you can't go too far wrong.
OK, very good. Now let's go on to dividend heroes quickly. Rachel, what exactly is a dividend?
So when you invest in a company, there are two potential ways that you could make money from it. One is the value of the share going up, and the other is the companies giving out a portion of their profits as dividends to their shareholders. And this has been a bit of a contentious issue recently because we're not seeing the same kind of payouts that we have seen in the past, and the old sort of the old reliables that were fairly foolproof are no longer so. Particularly, you know, energy companies, they're not quite cutting back yet, but there's definitely the expectation that they will do, and if they don't, then they should be, because they don't have the sort of underlying capital to be able to pay out. Sure. And they're just paying out through debt. But there, this is something that Simon's been looking into. There are still some companies that are still paying out dividends.
OK, let's hear some of them, Simon. Who are the dividend heroes who are still paying out?
Well, the AIC every year, which is the Association of Investment Companies, which is the investment trust trade body, rounds up its list of the dividend heroes. And these are the investment trusts, which are a form of investment where your money is pooled with others and they buy shares in other companies for you, who have raised their dividends every year for the longest period of time. And some of them go back a very long way. In fact, City of London Investment Trust has raised its dividend every single year for 49 years.
Wow.
And that is impressive. It also has an ongoing charge, I think, of only just above 0.4%, so it doesn't charge you much for investing there. And barring any form of major disaster, which I can't see them not doing this,
sure,
in a few months' time, it will announce its dividend for this year. And I expect that will go up and it will be 50, and I expect there will be some fanfare about it. So they've done 49. Bankers Investment Trust has done 49. Alliance Trust has done 49. But even at the bottom of this league of the top 20, Schroder Income Growth has raised its dividend every year for 20 years. Now, what's interesting about this is basically investment trusts have this ability to hold on to some of the dividends in the good years in order to pay out in the bad years. So instead of being hit by a scenario where, like 2008, 2009, stock market tumbled, financial crisis, a lot of companies were forced to cut their dividends, instead of them being forced to cut out what they pay to investors, they could use some of their reserves to keep raising that payout. And that's something that a traditional investment fund, can't do. It has to pay out all of its dividends. So that's one of the reasons why I like investment trusts for income investing, because they have this ability to smooth it. And, you know, these trusts, they vary. They're not all just income focused. They don't just all pay a big dividend. City of London, the top one, pays 4.2%. Scottish Mortgage, though, is much more targeted towards growth. Invests around the world in some really exciting tech companies in Asia and things like that. That only yields 1.2%. And I don't think I'm wrong by suggesting that we might have a mutual appreciation of investment trusts,
yes,
in this scenario, do we?
I do like investment trusts. In fact, we do a show here on Share Radio Weekly about investment trusts called The Investment Trust Show. So, yeah, no, I'm with you on this, Simon. But, of course, we should say you're investing in the stock market. This isn't like a no-risk investment, is it? It's attractive as it is.
Oh, no. I mean, the money that you invest could go down. There's no guarantee that the share price of these trusts won't fall. I mean, I think we can safely say that it's highly unlikely any of the ones on this list are going to leap to cut their dividend payment. But over the long term, you know, they've got pretty good performances, past performances, no guide to future returns and
sure,
all that. But, you know, dividends are one of the things that actually have the power to really boost your investing pot. And if you look at long-term stock market history, you will see that most of the long-term returns to savers come from compounding dividends over time. So I think this kind of investment is definitely the kind of thing that people should be looking at as potentially the core part of an investment portfolio, whether they go for an investment trust or a fund or an ETF or a tracker.
Sure. No, I agree with that. I actually have a bit of money in one of the trusts you mentioned there, the City of London Investment Trust. So I do hope it carries on increasing its dividend. As you say, Simon, let's just have a very quick rest.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.
Hello, I'm Ed Bauscher, in for Georgie Frost this week. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are back in the studio for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the big personal finance stories of the last 7 days. Of course, we do this show in partnership with NS&I, and this week I'm chatting to This Is Money editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. So let's now move on to central banks and some comments from Mark Carney, the current governor of the Bank of England, when he was about to take up his job in 2012.
Look, I'm not without ties to the United Kingdom. My wife is a British and Canadian national. My children are both. I lived there for a decade. I know a lot of people in the city, in industry, in the UK. And so I think that, obviously, I think that I can play a constructive role as the next governor in relaunching this institution with its new responsibilities, contributing to price stability, to financial stability, and to ensuring that the rebalancing of the UK economy, which is underway, but is seen through over the course of the next 5 years. This will be a very important transitional phase above for the institution itself, the Bank of England, but above all for the British economy. And I'm very honored and excited to be able to play a role in that.
A confident Mark Carney there, talking in 2012, gearing up to take over as Bank of England governor. The confidence might have been rocked a little of late, though, thanks to his predecessor, Mervyn King.
It was sensible to cut interest rates and to increase government spending in 2008, 2009, but that's a temporary solution. It's a painkiller, if you like. And if all you do with painkillers is keep taking them but never deal with the underlying symptoms, you don't get better. It's very clear that we are influenced and affected by what goes on in the euro area, and as I describe it, it has been a, I think, economic, if not disaster, very serious problem, and it's affecting us.
So the former Bank of England governor actually has a new book out. So naturally, he's been touring the interview circuit round all the different TV stations, radio stations, newspapers, all the rest of it. But this is happening at a time when the current governor, Mark Carney, is doing his best to warn of financial instability that a Brexit would cause. So, Simon, let's start with you. What's going on here?
Well, Mervyn King's talking his book, isn't he?
Yes.
I'm joking. I actually I quite like Mervyn King. I have a lot of respect for what he did as the Bank of England governor. And I think he was one of the few people who did actually warn about debt and the build-up of debt. Unfortunately, he didn't have anywhere near as much powers as the Bank of England have now to do anything about it. But what he said is that, you know, he said this thing about low rates and the danger of them becoming permanent. And he said that they needed to be a temporary solution or a painkiller. He said, if all you do with painkillers is keep taking them but never really deal with the underlying symptoms, you don't get better. So he said cutting rates was the right thing to do all those years back when we did that. But that we do need to be thinking about, you know, getting off that 0.5%. At the same time, we've then got some serious mixed messages, I think, coming from central bankers. In one scenario, you've got them saying, well, they could go down. In another, you've got them saying, no, they won't go down, they'll only go up. And then they're talking about, you know, financial instability and why we need to be worried. And it's funny, really, because central banking is a confidence game. So they should really be out there telling us that everything's OK, shouldn't they?
Well, yeah, I guess, to be fair, Mark Carney is kind of trying to do that, and Mervyn King doesn't need to bother now because he's got a book out. That's what's going on, I guess. Yeah, maybe. I mean, Rachel, what do you think? It's really hard to know. Some people say we should be whacking rates up because we can't carry on in this sort of low interest rate environment. Some people say let's have negative interest rates like the ECB. You got any idea what we should do, or are you just glad you're not governor of the Bank of England, which is where I am, I've got to say?
I don't know. I mean, even if I were, there aren't really that many things that they can do any longer. We talk so much about this toolkit that central banks have. And the problem really that has been heightened this week is that they're kind of running out of tools. Mm. And that's precisely what's causing problems in the market, why we're seeing a sort of these extraordinary yesterday currency fluctuations because they're running out of things to do. Mm. But I saw Mervyn King talk about this at the LSE last week, and he said that we really need to think more broadly about how we do things, that we're treating this sort of low interest rate, low growth new world in the same way that we have sort of previous recoveries and recessions. And it's just not the case, and it's not how it was. And I mean, I keep thinking about it as in a similar way to when you get poorly and you don't get better at the rate that you're expecting to, but you think that you should be getting better. So you sort of, you know, start going back to work or whatever you do, or taking on other things because you expect to be better. And I think it's the same with global economy. that we're trying the same old things. We're cutting interest rates, we're pumping more money into the economy, hoping that people will spend more, take on more debt, invest more, and it's absolutely not happening. And it's a new world, and we're having to cope with it. And he also argued that as such, we're just not in the place to do it yet, and we haven't gone so far as we need to in terms of beefing up the banks, making sure that we're prepared for the next crash.
Okay, Simon, one final word on this.
Well, I just think it's so fascinating that we are in a scenario where central bankers seem to think the worst possible thing we could do is get back to a situation where interest rates are anywhere near their long-term normal rate. But the idea of things like negative interest rates, helicopter cash, or abolishing cash altogether are palatable suggestions that are being discussed.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we haven't got long left, so let's talk about cars at the end. So how much would you pay for an old banger? £500, £1,000? Or what if it's in mint condition? Well, try £54,000. That's how much a 29-year-old D-Reg Fort Capri sold for the other day. The Capri 280 Brooklands smashed its original estimate of about £38,000 and sold for the same price as a brand new Jaguar F-Type Coupe. So, Simon, is this the kind of car you'd like to have if you had £54,000 going spare?
If I had £54,000 going spare, I probably wouldn't buy this Capri. Now, one of the reasons is because this Capri is worth £54,000 because it's only got 936 miles on the clock.
Oh, wow.
So basically, the original owner bought it and essentially hardly drove it and put it into a sort of temperature-controlled storage, sold it to the next owner, which is only the second owner in 2011, who then also looked after it in the same condition. So if you did buy it, basically, you couldn't really drive it because at the moment you start driving it, you start eating into what made it worth this world record £54,000. So I don't think I would buy a car you couldn't drive. But what I would say is I have actually driven one of these Capris.
All right.
Yeah, I drove one last summer. I went on a classic car driving day with a company called Great Escapes. They do these rallies where you drive like five different cars in a day. One of them was a Ford Capri 280 Brooklands. It had done more than 936 miles.
Okay.
I must admit that basically when I got behind the wheel of it was the first time I'd ever driven a Capri, and I suddenly got Ford Capris. I was like, I see what the fuss was about. It is really, really good fun to drive.
Oh, that is interesting. So I've always thought they're a bit naff. That really is interesting. All right. Well, we've run out of time. Thank you both of you so much. Simon Lambert, editor of This Is Money. Rachel Rickard Strauss, personal finance editor of This Is Money. You've been listening to the This Is Money show in partnership with NS&I. We've run out of time, so we'll be going to the news in just a minute.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.